This is The Guardian.
I'm Noor Haidar, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is the full story. Last week, 9 days after a bomb was allegedly thrown into an Invasion Day rally in Perth, police charged a 31-year-old man with engaging in a terrorist act. They allege he was seeking to advance what they described as a racially motivated ideological cause, saying he'd accessed pro-white material online. The wanting response from police, politicians and the media has left First Nations people feeling exposed and abandoned.
This is a low point because in 2026 we are a so-called enlightened modern nation, aware enough about our own history now to see that context of racism, surely. And for our institutions and our political leadership to continue to maintain that veneer of indifference to the fears and the, you know, the realities of life for First Nations people is just unacceptable.
Today, Lorena Allam from the University of Technology's Jimbana Institute for Indigenous Education and Research on Australia's history of racial violence and denial. It's Tuesday, the 10th of February. Lorena, it's good to have you back on Full Story, although in sobering circumstances.
Yeah, thanks, Noor. It's great to be back.
What went through your mind when you first heard that an explosive device, as it was being described at the time, had been thrown into a crowd of people at an Invasion Day rally in Perth?
I first thought, what? What's an explosive device? I could hear the quote marks. I mean, isn't it that a bomb? What other devices explode other than bombs? So I thought the language was strange. It's the language of euphemism to minimise the situation. And I mean, I know why police are cautious when they use that sort of language, because the situations are unfolding. But my first thought was, you know, my blood ran cold because I was thinking about how many old people and babies and children would have been in that crowd. And then I thought, of course, what does this say about how bad things have become in terms of race relations in this country? And like every other First Nations person, I was bracing myself for what was going to come out of this, because the system continually fails to see racism directed at us as exceptional or serious or worthy of a response.
Last week, 9 days after that bomb was allegedly thrown into the crowd, police confirmed that they were treating it as a terrorist act and that terrorism charges had been laid. That was the first time those charges have been used in the state of WA. How has that been received by First Nations people?
The charges. I think there was a tremendous sense of relief that he had been charged with that terrorism offence. I think the questions were swirling and continue to swirl about why it took them 9 days to do so. The police have to do things carefully and methodically, and in order to substantiate the charge as serious as that, there was a threshold and they had to investigate the man's motivations and search his home and whatever. So I understand that these things were necessary, but we also saw that it happened after sustained pressure from Indigenous leaders and allies, including independent media and a handful of First Nations journalists who work in the mainstream, who struggled very hard to keep this story alive and try and find new ways to cover the story while the police were investigating and trying to manage public anxiety and trying to report how Indigenous people were concerned while that was all unfolding.
Lorena, you were The Guardian's Indigenous Affairs editor and you've worked in newsrooms long enough to have a deep understanding of the way that decisions are made in newsrooms about what gets covered and how it's covered. How do you reflect on the media coverage in the days immediately following the alleged attack?
Well, I wasn't in a newsroom when this unfolded, so I'm watching from outside. But it seemed to me that the media were happy to just report what the police and politicians were saying was happening. So on the day, the West Australian Premier, Roger Cook, was saying, we must remember what this day marks. And you think, oh, Invasion Day. And then he says, no, this Australia Day should be about unity, not division. Mm. So completely sidelining the purpose of the gathering, saying things like it runs against the very heart of what it means to be Australian. And we're like, well, no. Again, it's an Invasion Day rally that is about surviving the nation of Australia. The police commissioner, Cole Blance, was saying that at this current stage, the police were treating it as a, quote, hostile act. When he was originally charged with criminal offences, the politicians seemed okay with that. The prime minister said they were serious offences. And he said, in my view, quote, as a result of that, they should throw the book at him. There was an implied satisfaction with the criminal charge being enough, even though Indigenous people who were organisers of the rally and others around the country were saying, hang on, if this is some kind of explosive device thrown into a crowd, surely it's more than a criminal offence. This is striking terror into people's hearts.
Mm.
The media reported that. They reported the mild language and the euphemism and the cautious nature of the response from police and politicians, and then got on with the rest of their day.
Lorena, you've written in a piece for The Guardian that this is a low point in Australia's long history of colonial terrorism against Indigenous people. Mm. I was hoping you could elaborate on that.
Well, by colonial terrorism, I mean the violence of invasion, the violence of frontier massacres, more than 400 of them over a 180-year period. The last mass killing of Aboriginal people happened at Coniston in the Northern Territory in 1927. So we're talking about a very recent history of mass killings, forced assimilation. You know, our people rounded up and hunted onto missions and reserves. My own grandmother talked about being raised behind barbed wire in conditions like a concentration camp in Western New South Wales in her childhood. We have child removals and all the other forms of legal discrimination that our people experienced for more than two centuries. So in that context of colonial terrorism, this is a low point, because in 2026, we are a so-called enlightened modern nation, aware enough about our own history now to see that context of racism, surely. And for our institutions and our political leadership to continue to maintain that veneer of indifference to the fears and the, you know, the realities of life for First Nations people is just unacceptable. As Lydia Thorpe, Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe, described the double standards at play in the aftermath of this attempted bombing. I mean, so many people called it out. So many people in just daily conversations with each other were saying, you know, bewildered by why authorities weren't treating this as seriously as other incidents of racial violence that had happened in recent times in Australia. And particularly post-referendum, there is an indifference at best to Indigenous people.
I want to ask about the impact of the referendum. I've heard many people say that the failed referendum and the debate that surrounded it made things worse. It normalised racism. Mm. What has been the impact of that referendum in 2023, looking back on that now, 2 years on?
Yes, well, during the referendum, when we were reporting on it, we could tell that the violence directed at Indigenous people was on the rise. And so 13Young, which is the specialised hotline for Aboriginal and Islander people to report racist incidents and racial violence, told us then that during the Voice referendum, the calls were up 40%. And Marjorie Anderson, who was the CEO of 13Young, said that the phone lines just went berserk, was her phrase, on the night that the vote was unsuccessful. And she said, you know, the debate was so nasty, it sort of gave people permission to be openly racist. And that was certainly what we saw and heard during the referendum. And afterwards, there was still a nasty culture war being perpetrated by the No campaigners, who wanted to make the Voice referendum vote into a culture war about welcomes to country and, you know, councils flying Aboriginal flags. So those culture wars plus the vote have kind of given permission to people to be openly racist. And post-referendum, the Human Rights Commission developed and gave to the government an anti-racism framework in 2024. That has, to my knowledge, just been gathering dust. There have been no formal responses by the government to those recommendations by the Human Rights Commission.
Mm.
So racism is definitely on the rise. In August last year, we saw Camp Sovereignty in Naam 40 men from an ultra right-wing group marauding through the camp. You know, some of them had sticks and pickets, and four people in the camp were taken to hospital. You know, a number of men, I think 8 or 9 men were charged following that incident. But this is the climate we live in now, where peaceful protests, not even protests, but gatherings, are not safe any longer.
We'll be right back. After the terror charge was laid, co-chair of the Uluru Statement, Pat Anderson, released a statement, and she said that the attack and the sluggish, inert response of elected leaders is a stark reminder of how Aboriginal people are viewed and treated in this country. Mm. The message that hurt her the most was that of silence. The silence was overwhelming, she said. And she added that Indigenous people live in a reality knowing that it's never been the government's priority to keep them safe. Mm. She says that the voice to Parliament, had it been enshrined, would have spoken up. Do you think that moments like this now show the importance of a representative body like The Voice, or what it might have been able to do?
Absolutely. I agree with that. I think I said in the piece that I wrote for The Guardian that a voice to Parliament would be able to take carriage of this work for the government, you know, in helping to push forward on awareness of what anti-racism work looks like and what work we all need to do, individuals and institutions, to make lasting change in this country. First Nations people notice that there are envoys to Parliament advising them on how to respond to race hate in the community. And, you know, it's well past time that they listen to First Nations people about the race hate that we experience. You know, this was an Invasion Day gathering, the one day of the year we all dread, because it's the day that Australia celebrates the start of genocide. So every year we peacefully gather our families together, kids, old folks, you know, people in wheelchairs, you name it, we all come together because it's the day for our community to get together and offer support to each other, show that we love each other, and it becomes that kind of, it's the energy that gets you through the rest of the year. Mm. So for someone to throw a bomb, whether it went off or not is irrelevant, but it strikes at the heart of what it means to be a First Nations person in this country. Mm. Our people face racism, the interpersonal and the structural kind, every day. The statistics are there for everyone to see. There's discrimination in education, housing, health, the justice system, you name it. Deaths in custody have never been as bad. They're the worst on record. Our kids are being taken from our families at alarming rates. Our social markers are going backwards if you look at the latest Closing the Gap statistics. So if this terror charge that's been laid, it might have taken 9 days, but it's very welcomed. But it doesn't resolve the fact that people are now terrified. And it is long past time for governments to step in and do something about it.
I want to ask you about that, Lorena, because what happened at that Invasion Day rally hasn't spurred the same kind of policy and political debate that other comparable incidents have. Many want the government to take action against racism and violence that Indigenous people, Indigenous communities face. What could or should that action involve?
Well, the organisers of the Perth rally released a statement last week that's, you know, welcomed the charges, welcomed the opportunity that they had to speak to the police and to the Premier, but called for the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion to be expanded, its terms of reference to include all forms of violence and discrimination, because clearly, in their view, here's an example of how our social cohesion is extremely fragile for lots of Australians, not just Jewish and Muslim Australians. And they also called for a greater awareness of our colonial history and a focus on truth-telling. There were also calls, which I think are extremely important, for dedicated services to help Aboriginal people, counselling services, so Aboriginal people can, you know, talk to somebody about their fears and anxieties. you know, things that have only gotten worse since the failed referendum, but certainly worse since Invasion Day or January 26th this year.
As you've just noted, there have been renewed calls for the federal government to establish a national truth-telling process or a federal truth and justice commission. Your piece for The Guardian this week spoke about denial. Does that sit at the heart of all this?
Yeah, it does. Denial is something that's a personal psychological response to things that are troubling that you don't want to face, but it's also an institutional response to troubling recognition about hypocrisy in our society. So yeah, I think denial is very prevalent. It's very much a part of this story.
So how might a Truth and Justice Commission help?
Well, I have some views about truth commissions and their effectiveness broadly, but yes, of course, a truth commission or truth commissions are really important as sort of a civic education process. They're extremely helpful because they provide, as in the same way that this upcoming Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion will do, is put those issues on the public agenda day after day and create public discourse and public awareness. So in that sense, truth commissions are really important and they provide that civic education role. But truth seeking, genuine truth seeking and telling has to be accompanied by listening to have any impact. So a truth commission can't, in my view, be a closed door thing. It has to be very public. It is a public facing and a little bit of a performative process. So I think we need to be realistic about what truth commissions can actually achieve. If we go into them understanding that they are an educative process, that's great. But they don't bring justice. They can be a place where people can speak their truth and be heard, but justice is an entirely different process. But I also happen to think that interpersonal truth-telling is also really important and powerful and in some ways more meaningful for people who are trying to make sense of what happened in the past in the places where they live. I think it was Amanda Nettelbeck, the historian, who talked about how the violence of the frontier was very intimate. While people were killing indiscriminately, they often knew, the perpetrators often knew their victims and lived in close proximity to them. Because it was so intimate and interpersonal, I think the truth-telling needs to be intimate and personal as well. You know, there's that old saying, all the truth and as much justice as possible. I think that's very relevant in this case. I don't think there's any political institution, least of all the nation state of Australia, who can be entrusted with rationing the truth about its own history. And, you know, people will say, oh, look, there's no justice that can be administered or justice can't prevail for the atrocities that have happened. And to a certain extent, that is true. But I'm reminded of what the historian Michael Ignatieff said, which is that the choice is not between truth and justice. It is between the amount of past injustice that is and is not tolerable. It's about what we as a nation can live with and what we as a nation can come to an agreed understanding as the truth of our history. And until we do that, incidents like this will just keep happening.
Lorena Allam, we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Noor.
That was Lorena Allam from the Jumbana Institute for Indigenous Education and Research at the University of Technology. And we've linked to her latest opinion piece on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert. Sound design and mixing by Daniel Simo. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget, you can subscribe or follow Full Story and you can also leave us a review. I'm Noor Haidar. Thanks for listening.